You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 23rd of November 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, two narratives fight for oxygen in the US, with Joe Biden and his team still unable to begin to make the transition to the presidency, and Donald Trump digs his heels in even further, despite his loss becoming clearer. We'll have the latest. Also coming up, more demonstrations in Thailand suggest the government still can't make the protests stop, despite an increased use of violence by the authorities. And we ask what the world's retailers can do to survive the busiest time of the year in a period of austerity and shuttered shop fronts. Plus, a dose of good news from Andrew Muller.
By this time next week, Giuliani might have attempted to eat one of his own hands in a bowling alley car park somewhere in Nevada, while insisting that the election has been stolen by the CIA, the Osmonds, and the ghost of Pancho Villa.
We'll look at Monday's newspapers too. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. The Hong Kong democracy activist Joshua Wong has pleaded guilty to unlawful assembly during last year's protests. He now faces up to 5 years in jail. The head of the US coronavirus vaccine program says he expects to begin an aggressive immunization program in the next 3 weeks. And the Prime Minister of Ethiopia has given the armed forces of the Tigray region 3 days to surrender or to face military action. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, it is nearly 3 weeks since the US went to the polls and voted Joe Biden in as their next president. Now, while the rest of the world's news agendas have moved on from their burning focus on the most important election in a generation, things are stubbornly still stuck in Washington as Donald Trump digs his heels in and reportedly skipped an appearance at the G20 summit, preferring to head instead to the golf course. Well, to bring us up to date, I'm joined by Brian Klass, who's Associate Professor in Global Politics at UCL here in London and a columnist for the Washington Post. Brian, welcome. What's the latest? This weekend didn't bring any better news for Donald Trump, did it? It was Michigan, Georgia and Pennsylvania too.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost silly to be talking about it as news. I mean, he lost the election and it's extremely clear. And if this were any other election in any other country, we would have just moved on because the results speak for themselves. So yes, he continues to suffer court setbacks, but the bottom line is quite clear that he's lost. And his attempt now is to try to subvert the Democratic election and stay in power. That's very, very unlikely to happen. But the fact that it's an attempt is still worrying, and it's still doing immense damage because the Republican Party is backing Trump, and Trump's supporters are believing his lies. And again, we should call them what they are, they're lies. He's making up evidence, he's making up false accusations without evidence of voter fraud, and he's convincing his supporters that is reality. So it will do damage to the legitimacy of the democratic process, but it is completely based on lies, and it has no merit in reality. So we're in a dangerous position for the next 60-odd days as this gets sorted out, but Biden will be the next president.
In the meantime, you were saying that the Republicans are backing Trump, but we now hear that one of his closest allies, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, has now said that the president's legal team is a national embarrassment, and he's urging President Trump to basically give up his efforts. When Chris Christie wades into the argument, is it not a sign that actually the tide is now prominently turning against Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's too early to say that. I mean, you know, we're talking about the tide turning against somebody who's, you know, rejecting a Democratic election, and still there's a tiny minority of Republicans who have called Joe Biden president-elect or said anything to the effect that Donald Trump lost. I mean, you can count on two hands the number of prominent Republicans who have accepted reality. That's not something that you're supposed to praise in politics. It's not politically brave to acknowledge this, right? I mean, we wouldn't be talking in the UK about, oh, how wonderful that another Labour politician acknowledged that Boris Johnson is the prime minister. I mean, this is just reality and fact. And you still have only a few. And of course, Chris Christie is not holding an elected position right now. So there's, of elected Republicans, there are only a handful who have actually come around and said, yes, Joe Biden will be the president. It's time to move on. And so, you know, I think this is one of those areas where things are radically worse than I thought they would be, in the sense of, I figured Trump would reject the election results, but I thought he would be twisting in the wind alone a bit, especially given how decisive the result is. Keep in mind, Biden won the Electoral College with the same margin as Trump won 4 years ago, 306 electoral votes, so well beyond the 270 threshold. And his popular vote lead, which is still growing, is over 6 million votes. I mean, this was not a nail-biter election. It was one of the most decisive contests in modern history. So I think when we think about it in those terms, the fact that we only can point to a handful of people who have acknowledged this reality is the very disturbing story of this weird era in U.S. politics.
Who's leading the charge to support Donald Trump from within the Republicans? And what is it that they're doing it? Is it simply self-preservation, knowing that nothing in politics lasts forever and there might be a chance in 2024?
Yeah, I think that Donald Trump has completely captured the Republican Party. And so Republicans in the party have decided that they don't want to alienate the base by accepting a reality that the base does not want to accept. And you saw this in some really interesting ways over the weekend. So Tucker Carlson, one of the prominent figures on Fox News, basically laid out for his audience in very sympathetic terms that he wanted to believe the charges that the Trump campaign was making, but he was asking various lawyers, including this lawyer, Sidney Powell, for evidence, and she could not provide any. So he effectively communicated that. And the backlash was very swift. People saying they weren't going to watch Tucker Carlson's show anymore. And you have growing ratings on totally unhinged news networks like OAN and Newsmax, which continue to claim that Trump is winning or is going to win. So you have this sort of delusional base that is going to move with its money and its advertising revenue and where it watches TV based on who is willing to cling to the lie the longest. And this may be true politically as well with the Republican Party, where some of the candidates are going to try to make, you know, political hay out of the fact that they're willing to indulge Donald Trump's fantasy as long as possible. But in the meantime, it's doing this damage that I said before. And you also have this very strange disarray in the Republican legal team, the Trump legal team, where Sidney Powell, the lawyer that I mentioned, I mean, she led one of the most bizarre press conferences in American history this past week, in which she effectively claimed that a hodgepodge of Hugo Chavez, who's dead, and a few other people have been conspiring against Donald Trump. And then afterwards, they all got together and tweeted, "Release the Kraken," in reference to evidence that supposedly exists, but no one has seen. And then just yesterday, the Republican legal team said Sidney Powell has never been part of the Trump legal team and was acting in a personal capacity as though she just wandered in off the street and gave a briefing at the Trump legal campaign press conference. So the whole thing is bizarre and damaging, but at its core, it's authoritarian. It's trying to undercut the results of a clear and decisive and fair presidential election, and that should give everyone cause for concern.
So where is the mechanism that can prevent this from continuing and undermining what you say is effectively the whole democratic system in the U.S.?
You know, there's so much in U.S. politics, and this is true across democracies, that relies on good faith and norms. It relies on people doing things because they understand that if they've lost an election, they have to concede, for example. So the question that the Democrats will have, and this will be affected by whether they have control of the Senate come January after the Georgia special elections, is how much attention and effort are they going to pay to codifying or creating in law things that used to be norms? And I think an example of this is unblocking the funds that have been allocated for a transitional team that Biden needs to get, you know, up to speed and up and running so he's ready on January 20th. And right now, the GSA, the General Services Administration, has discretion over when to do that. And a Trump appointee, Emily Murphy, is refusing to do so, pointing as precedent to the 2000 election that dragged on for weeks, which was decided, I'll remind our listeners, by 537 votes, not 6 million, and not with, you know, five states flipped to the winning candidate. So it's not even close to a parallel. But this is a great example of something that probably should be put into law, where if there's a clear-cut victory, they need to at least preliminarily unlock the funds so that this doesn't damage U.S. national security or, of course, in this context, make it harder for Biden to get up to speed on the pandemic, which is going to be the core thing he deals with come January 20th.
What quite a few people are finding astonishing is that there is an element of surprise that Donald Trump that would fight this way. I think there'd been several voices, yours included, Brian, that had said that Donald Trump, and Donald Trump himself actually, would say that he would contest the election as fraud even before things had kicked off. Why are people so surprised that this is lasting so long? Because one, he was never going to go quietly.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those bizarre things about the Trump presidency, is that he clearly telegraphs how he's going to behave, and people don't want to believe it. You know, I've written about his authoritarianism for 5 years, and I wrote a book about it, and I wrote two op-eds, one in May, one in October, saying, look, he's going to reject the election results. We need to prepare for this. And I think people believe in American exceptionalism. I think people believe that, you know, oh, this, you know, this is just bluster. He'll never do this. He'll never try to go to the Republican state legislatures and ask them to seat different electors. I mean, he's trying to do that right now. So I think this is something where the belief that this just doesn't happen here is so ingrained in U.S. politics that when people who have seen this film before, right? I mean, I've studied authoritarianism around the world, and I've seen red flags popping up in the Trump administration since, well, before he was president, right? Since 2015 when he launched his campaign. Wishful thinking plays a very powerful role. And the assumption that the institutions will save us is ignoring the fact that institutions don't exist without people. People save us. And Donald Trump has captured a heck of a lot of people, not just in the electorate, but also in formal positions of power. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, is that it's the death spell of the presidency, but it's one that's not going to go quietly. And in the meantime, it is going to inflict serious damage on U.S. democracy, because so many of his supporters believe falsely that Biden did not win fair and square.
Finally, a quick question about Joe Biden and reports about the choice of the people he will have with him as he heads into January, if he ever gets in the building. Joe Biden's expected to choose, according to the New York Times, Antony Blinken and his Secretary of State. Your thoughts, please, on who he is and what he expects to bring to the administration?
Well, he's a very safe pick. Tony Blinken is the former Deputy Secretary of State, so he's the number two at the State Department under President Obama. You know, he was in the room when Obama ordered the Osama bin Laden raid, and when it was being carried out. So he's been very, very close to the centers of power in U.S. politics for a long time. And he's also somebody that will reassure allies, because he's very clearly, like Joe Biden, a multilateralist and has these relationships. So it's not somebody like Rex Tillerson, who was Trump's first Secretary of State, who was trying to learn on the job in a lot of ways. This is someone who intimately knows the State Department, intimately knows American allies, and will prioritize as his first job, I think, repairing the damage of the Trump administration, which is going to be a full-time job. There's a lot of damage, and it is extremely important for U.S. interests to try to repair it as quickly as possible. And that's what Tony Blinken's going to be focused on.
A small glimmer of hope there from Brian Klass. Thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist.
We're changing the way we do subscriptions at Monocle, and there's never been a better time to sign up. We've just launched our first ever digital subscription. The new look Monocle Digital Editions offers improved access to the magazine on the go, at the touch of a button, and is rather dashing too. It also includes our extensive archive of global reporting and a growing roster of travel guides and tips. Whether you opt for print and digital or digital only, your subscription will include unlimited access to the Monocle Digital Editions. That goes for existing subscribers too. Head to monocle.com/subscribe to sign up.
8:15 in Berlin, 7:15 here in London. You're with The Globalist, with me, Emma Nelson. There were two firsts to the annual G20 summit of the world's richest nations this weekend. It was hosted by Saudi Arabia, and it happened largely online. King Salman led for calls for poorer nations to be given access to vaccines and other resources necessary to combat coronavirus. But the run-up was marked by demands from human rights groups that the Saudis release detained activists and journalists. Well, joining me is Iona Craig, a journalist who specialises in the Arab Peninsula. A very warm welcome back. Good morning, Iona.
Good morning.
So, for the first time in a very long time, it wasn't the subjects discussed that dominated the headlines at the start, at least of the G20. It was the hosts.
Yes, and I think probably rightly so in this case. When Saudi Arabia was given the presidency a year ago now for the G20, it was 14 months after the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, where he was supposedly dismembered. So this is really part of a kind of rehabilitation plan, really, for Saudi Arabia. And it seems kind of quite extraordinary, really, that the G20 has helped Saudi Arabia in this and really is kind of whitewashing its human rights record, which isn't just about Jamal Khashoggi, of course, in the process of all of this.
Tell us a little bit more about how much of a distraction this has been from the business at hand. The headlines yesterday at the end of the G20 were all about pledges of access to a coronavirus vaccine for all. But was there a sense here that the G20 was going to be very different because of Saudi Arabia, insofar as there were these underlying issues which were impossible to address via a Zoom call?
Yes and no. I think certainly the conversation within the G20 would barely be affected, would not even be touched on, really. I mean, I think all of the Western leaders sort of claim that they will speak about human rights issues in Saudi Arabia, but I think we have to take that with a large pinch of salt and that it might be mentioned in hushed tones or under breath for a few seconds at best. But yes, the conversation certainly outside of the room, in the international media, for example, that's why we're having this conversation now, is about Saudi Arabia's human rights record. But I think really for Saudi Arabia, this is a sort of calculation or a risk assessment they would have taken when they agreed to take on the G20 presidency. And for them, the benefits to come out of it are far greater, the sort of rehabilitation, as I mentioned, into the international community, but also it being an economic forum and their long-term vision and plan for the kingdom itself. I think any sort of bad press that they might have over the space of 3 or 4 days can quickly be swept under the carpet in the interests of their kind of long-term vision, which is part of Vision 2030 for their socio-economic plans for Saudi Arabia over the next sort of 10 years. So I think, yes, for them, they can put up with this sort of noise outside the room as long as it's not happening inside the room, which I think, as you mentioned, particularly with a Zoom situation where everything is happening online, you're not even going to be able to have those quiet conversations inside rooms that perhaps parts of delegations would normally have if they were meeting in person at a kind of conference situation over a long weekend.
What should have happened then, in your opinion, Iona? Should Saudi Arabia have not been allowed to host the G20?
Yes, I think so. You've got to remember that Saudi Arabia has signed up to various international conventions, including the Convention Against Torture, including the Convention on the Rights of Persons, on the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women. And yes, you can argue that how do we make sure that Saudi Arabia upholds those kind of treaties that they've ratified and they've signed? Yes, we can't send sort of a police force into Saudi Arabia to enforce them, but we can say you will not host the G20 until you have done X, Y, Z. And of course, that just doesn't happen. And as we saw over the weekend, you've got Boris Johnson sitting there in front of a Saudi flag as well as the British flag, which other European leaders did not go so far as to do, which is a clear indication, you know, that all is fine and these kind of this kind of human rights record or human rights abuses will be essentially ignored for, you know, what is believed to be the greater good of governments by maintaining their relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is all about financial interests, ultimately.
Organisations have taken the opportunity, however, to use the G20 as a chance to highlight other issues which are connected to Saudi Arabia. I'm thinking in particular of Save the Children, talking about the fighting in Yemen, and the fact that more children are being killed and injured than at any that for a significant time. Is there an opportunity here for issues like Yemen to be brought back into the public's consciousness?
Yes, I think so. And also, actually, amongst the delegation, it's probably more likely to be spoken of than any of the certainly domestic human rights issues that we're talking about. And we're talking about activists that are being detained or the 34 Saudi journalists that are being detained. The issue of Yemen is one that can be spoken about more easily by other states. And again, as you say, in the public conscious, I mean, this is a war that's now about to go into its seventh year. We're at this, slightly difficult time at the moment with the transition in the US and Saudi Arabia's perception of what will happen next, particularly between America and Iran now, and probably very importantly as well, what Trump may or may not do in the interim before Biden is sworn in January. So there's a little bit of an uncertainty in this time period, but it may be an opportunity to put pressure on both the Houthis and the Saudis to at least maybe speed up the process of reaching some sort of ceasefire, which is being talked about at the moment and has a lot to do with that pressure coming from the US with the transition period.
Iona Craig, as ever, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's Globalist, Andrew Muller brings us some light relief in the shape of some good news.
There has also been a bunch of good news this week for people who enjoy flapping and squawking emperors more generally.
That's all to come on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Thousands of people joined a protest by high school students in central Bangkok this weekend. Along with demands for education reforms, they called for a change of government and curbs on the power of the royal family. It's the first demonstration in the Thai capital since the government vetoed demands to change the role of the powerful monarchy. To tell us more, I'm joined from Bangkok by our correspondent Gwen Robinson. Hello, Gwen. Good to have you with us again. Just tell us about the nature of the protests in the last week or so, because there have been two kinds, haven't there? The one that I mentioned at the moment, the sort of more light-hearted one, but the protest movement itself has been subject to rather harsher crackdowns.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's what makes it so hard at this point to keep track and really get a pattern of the way these protests are going. But last week, I mean, it was truly shocking even to a lot of the journalists who've been covering this thing from the beginning that handguns, or at least one, was used, and at least five, some say six, protesters suffered bullet wounds. That was confirmed by one of the key medical services in Bangkok. And that is an extremely alarming development. It seems clear that that was not from the police side, and this was a hand pistol. Nobody is saying who, but it does seem that it would have come from the very virulent pro-royalist demonstrators who've been out there and trying to counter the student-led protests. And this could signal a new phase, which is, a far uglier and more active stance on the part of actually both. I mean, some of these students are fighting back. On the other hand, as you say, very light-hearted protests after that during the week, straight after that one, actually, and also on the weekend, that featured, creative protests, people dressed up, poking fun at the monarchy, at the government, music, some star performers, and a lot of wit, actually. And that really gave a very different tone. And again, yesterday, there was another more lighthearted, festive protest. But I think the big one people are looking to is on Wednesday, where some of the core student groups will descend on what is known as the Crown Property Bureau, which is the office that used to hold all the royal assets on behalf of the monarchy. It should be said that the current king has now transferred most of those assets under his personal name, but the Crown Property Bureau stands as a symbol of all that the student movement is opposing right now.
To have this level of protest and this sustained level of protest as well suggests that the authorities, no matter what they are saying in terms of the government wishing to use all its powers against protests who challenge the law, they've got a problem that will not go away now. Protesters have been doing this for a long time.
Exactly. You put your finger on it. I think the government is clearly exasperated and possibly to buy time and maybe to try and buy off some of the protesters. There is a process now going in Thai Parliament here to discuss, debate proposals to rewrite the constitution. Now, the constitution, I won't even bore you listeners with the details, but there's a lot in this current Thai constitution that was brought in under a coup government, which seized power in 2014, and the constitution does enshrine certain powers to the monarchy and also a very skewed political system that enables a government-controlled Senate to veto a lot of key proposals to change both the constitution and key aspects of the law. So 7 proposals were submitted to Parliament and only 2 passed. And that is only to commence discussion. It gives another 45 days for discussion of putting a proposal to a referendum and constituting a constitutional drafting committee. Of course, all this, if it goes ahead, will take a very long time. And I don't think it's going to answer what you correctly point out is this sense of persistence and urgency amongst the student-led protests. They're not going to wait a year and a half for some constitutional committee that is largely government-dominated to come up with yet another constitution that will reinforce the whole problematic system now. So it is very hard to see where it goes from here. The students are not going away. There are protests planned almost every day or every second day. And the thing is, it's not just in Bangkok. They are being held around the country. They're just not getting the kind of media that obviously the ones in Bangkok are. So I think that's a real problem for the government. And how they answer this, whether more violence, remains a big question, because right now there are a lot of kids at the forefront of these protests. And I think the Thai government is not stupid. They know that pictures of high school students in school uniform being tear gassed is not going to be a very good image for Thailand. So at the moment, there is some restraint being exercised. There wasn't last week when they did use water cannons again. But you're not seeing the kind of really violent scenes we're seeing, for example, in Indonesia, where there's riots being put down very violently by police.
Gwen Robinson, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's programme, we assess the chances of our high streets as the run-up to Christmas diverts everybody online, and we'll also go through the newspapers too. But first, with the time 7:29 here in London, a quick summary now on some of the other news headlines. The Hong Kong democracy activist Joshua Wong has pleaded guilty to unlawful assembly during last year's protests. Mr. Wong and several other defendants now face up to 5 years in jail. The head of the US coronavirus vaccine program says he expects to begin an aggressive immunization program within the next 3 weeks. Dr. Monsef Slaoui said 2 vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna could be officially approved by the 11th of December, and that up to 20 million people are likely to be vaccinated by the end of the year. And the Prime Minister of Ethiopia has given the armed forces of the Tigray region 3 days to surrender or face military action. Earlier, the Ethiopian military had warned people in the Tigrayan capital to expect artillery fire. Those are the headlines on Monocle 24. Let's continue with some good news stories. Here's Andrew Muller.
Welcome to the 34th of these weekly forlorn rifles through the record fair bargain bin full of dog-eared Billy Joel albums that is the COVID-19 newscape in search of the something actually listenable of good news. Everybody's talking about the new sound, funny, but it's still rock and roll to me. That'll do, Joel. Good news this week for people who like penguins, and who doesn't? We weren't really referring there to the mildly popular 1950s doo-wop ensemble, the Penguins, but let's run with it. It's a step up from Billy Joel, but what isn't? It turns out that there are more penguins at large than was previously believed. This was discovered by a group of frankly insufferably precocious Scottish teenagers as part of a science project at Stirling High School. The kids developed an algorithm which identifies penguin colonies from satellite images and found a bunch of them. 11 new colonies of emperor penguins, adding roughly 20% to the world's known population thereof. All potential punchlines here were discarded in favour of merely reiterating that there are a lot more penguins than we thought, and that this is just excellent. You can never have too many penguins. It can only be hoped that Stirling High's brightest are now turning their attention to numbats, the endangered stripy marsupial native to Western Australia, and a particular favourite of this monologue. Look it up later. You won't regret it. Numbats. We're going to need that gear-grinding sound effect again. Because, if you'll put the numbats to one side for the moment and keep the penguins in mind for the purposes of enabling this segue, there has also been a bunch of good news this week for people who enjoy flapping and squawking emperors more generally. Actually, do penguins squawk? Ah, near enough. By which we mean, flapping, squawking emperors, come on, this is gold, that the post-election twilight of Donald Trump's presidency of the United States is continuing to furnish a quantity and quality of schadenfreude that almost compensates for having to put up with the big goose for 4 years, and we've thought about this long and hard, that counts as good news in the wider general context. Because, and stick with us here, there's something kind of heartwarming about the spectacle of the representatives of Earth's most powerful individual stomping into various courthouses in an attempt to stand over hitherto obscure local officials and receiving, by way of reply, a legalese variation on "get the heck out of here with this flapdoodle, balderdash, bunkum, baloney, and, if you will, hogwash." Consider, for example, the dismissal of Trump's suit against the state of Pennsylvania, with Monocle's frivolous litigation desk chief Carlotta Ribello playing the role of unimpressed middle district judge and, to delectably ice an already delicious cake, Republican Matthew Bran.
One might expect that when seeking such a startling outcome, a plaintiff would come formidably armed with compelling legal arguments and factual proof of rampant corruption, such that this court would have no option but to regrettably grant the proposed injunctive relief, despite the impact it would have on such a large group of citizens. That has not happened. Instead, this court has been presented with strained legal arguments without merit and speculative accusations unpled in the operative complaint and unsupported by evidence.
No sale in Arizona either, where Bill Gates, a Republican member of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, explained why he was certifying the votes which tipped the state for President-elect Joe Biden.
You know, it's important for everyone to understand that the reason that I'm here is because I was inspired by my grandfather, who's a World War II vet. He went to Europe to fight for democracy. Mr. Hickman referenced the fact that I'm a lawyer, and when I became a lawyer, I took an oath to support the Constitution and the laws of the United States and the state of Arizona.
President Benito Cartman's various legal challenges against results in the 2020 election are, of course, being masterminded by Rudy Giuliani, the thought of whose next stunt prompts anticipation unrivaled since the pomp of Harry Houdini. By this time next week, Giuliani might have attempted to eat one of his own hands in a bowling alley car park somewhere in Nevada, while insisting that the election has been stolen by the CIA, the Osmonds, and the ghost of Pancho Villa. Trump Trump's lawsuits are now running at one win from 31 starts, which is obviously good news in and of itself, but good news for the general gaiety, as those of Trump's circle who've left it a bit late to make their bolt for Buenos Aires in fake beards and priest costumes dig themselves in ever deeper. Here's Trump's press secretary and future First Week ejectee from I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, Kayleigh McEnany, justifying her boss's epic salt.
This president was never given an orderly transition of power. His presidency was never accepted.
And here's Trump 4 years ago.
And we are grateful to President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama for their gracious aid throughout this transition. They have been magnificent.
The good news is both that there's only a couple more months of this nonsense, and yet that there's two whole more months of this nonsense. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
And my thanks to Andrew Muller and all the team who pull that together. You're The Globalist. Let's continue with today's newspapers on The Globalist. Joining me on the line is Phil Clark, Professor of International Politics at SOAS University of London. Hello, Phil. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Let us begin immediately with Ethiopia, where the situation is worsening as was expected.
That's right. This is the story on the Al Jazeera website this morning. It's in a lot of the newspapers today that the Ethiopian government have given the TPLF rebels in Tigray in the north of Ethiopia a three-day ultimatum to surrender. The Ethiopian forces are planning a big attack on Mekele, which is the capital of Tigray region. It's a big city. It has about 600,000 people there. The government are given a very stark message to the civilians in Mekele that they need to save themselves. They've basically got now 2.5 days to get out of the city. The fear here is that there's going to be a huge attack with a massive civilian death toll and real concerns about the spiraling humanitarian situation in northern Ethiopia at the moment.
Tell us a little bit more about the international involvement here. The focus very much has been on threats from the Prime Minister or promises from the Prime Minister that the rebels have got 72 hours to lay down their arms or expect consequences. But when you have neighbours having to cope with a mass exodus of refugees, where does that leave countries like Sudan and Eritrea?
This has been the big concern about what's happening in Ethiopia for the last couple of weeks, Emma, is that this could really spiral out of control and become a regional conflict and something that's not just relegated to Ethiopia's borders. This piece on the Al Jazeera website highlights that about 31,000 Tigrayan refugees have already fled into neighbouring Sudan. This is a conflict that's already embroiled neighbouring Eritrea. The Tigrayan rebels fired on the Asmara airport in Eritrea about a week ago because Eritrea is supporting the Ethiopian government here. And all of this comes at a really tense regional time anyway. There are really tough negotiations going on between Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt over a couple of big dams in the region. That's been a political controversy rumbling for a year or more. And there were concerns that that could even lead to conflict. That was before any of this happened in northern Ethiopia. The Al Jazeera piece has got a couple of interviews with humanitarian workers who are talking about just how chaotic the situation is, especially on that border between Ethiopia and Sudan. And the Sudanese government have already said they're very worried about a massive refugee influx and their ability to care for those refugees. So this is very quickly becoming a very serious regional situation.
Let's move on to an article in today's Guardian here from the UK. Just as a bit of background, the British Chancellor Rishi Sunak faced with the worst peacetime deficit I think ever known, is having to think of ways of cutting money, and one of them is to cut the overseas aid budget. It seems like an easy hit, yet there has been a widespread condemnation of any move, saying that this is just short-termism.
Yes, there's this piece in The Guardian today highlighting that seven political parties in the UK have written to Rishi Sunak to say that there should be a ring fencing of this aid budget. The UK has been very proud of the fact for the last 10 or 15 years that it's one of the few countries around the world that has met that UN guideline that countries should spend 0.7% of GDP on foreign aid. It looks like what Sunak is proposing, which is a £4 billion cut to the aid budget, would reduce that to 0.5%. GDP. And this letter from MPs today comes on the back of two former prime ministers, David Cameron and Tony Blair, coming out at the end of last week and saying that the aid shouldn't be cut. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, said a similar thing on Friday. And I guess the argument is that if you cut aid, you have a massive impact on the ground. In fact, in places like Sudan and Ethiopia, that's where UK money is being spent in very desperate humanitarian situations like that. But also that this is very short-term thinking, even in terms of the UK's own interests, that the UK's image overseas is very much backed by its aid spending. And also, if you think about the fact that, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, many states have done a very effective job of tackling the coronavirus situation, often using foreign aid for those kinds of means. The failure to deal with coronavirus is then the kind of thing that has global consequences. It produces problems that can eventually blow back and affect Britain. So this isn't just about charity. This is also about Britain's national interest. The other thing that's pointed out by these MPs in their letter today is that Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson last week very loudly proclaimed that they were increasing the UK's military spending by £16 billion. So the argument is obviously, well, if you can find £16 billion for militaristic activity around the world, why is this leading to a cutback in aid giving? There seems to be a massive imbalance of priorities here.
It points to a wider reshaping of the way that the United Kingdom would like to be seen on the world stage. But it's a little earlier this year, wasn't it, that the Foreign Office and the Department for International Development, which deals with foreign aid in the UK, were merged. And many at that point suggested that foreign aid was suddenly becoming a political thing in a way that it possibly shouldn't be.
That's exactly right. I think we are seeing a complete rejigging of the way the UK thinks about aid. And the bigger context here, of course, is Brexit. I think this is also part of an inward-looking society, an inward-looking state. It's a government that's saying it's about Britain first. We're going to look after Britain's interests. And as you said, even the aid budget now is being brought into this idea of the national interest. And hence, we've seen that merging of the ministry. I think these most recent aid cuts fit a pattern that's been developing for a couple of years. And the right-wing press in the UK have been very heavy on this issue. They've been accusing the government of being way too generous with its foreign aid budget. And it looks like Sunak is using the current circumstances this week to do exactly what the right-wing press have been calling for a long time.
A lot of the press has its eyes on a courtroom in Paris because the former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, is going on trial from today, accused of corruption. Now, this is not the easiest thing to explain, is it, Phil? So I don't know whether to leave it to you. It involves wiretapping a phone call between Nicolas Sarkozy and his lawyer about possible interference in another investigation into his I think it was his presidential campaign in 2007, wasn't it?
That's right. So this is a piece on the Reuters website, but of course it's all over Le Monde and the French press and a lot of the international press today that this is, in fact, the first of no fewer than three corruption trials that Sarkozy's going to be embroiled in over the next 6 or 7 months. So the accusation in the first trial, which starts today, is that Sarkozy tried to bribe a judge who was looking into illegal payments made to his campaign around that 2007 election, and specifically payments that allegedly were made by the L'Oreal heiress, Liliane Bettencourt. This is something that the French courts have been looking into for quite a while, is the fact that Sarkozy was able to develop this massive war chest basically by breaking election finance rules. And that often meant that he was cozying up to big business. So this current case is about whether he tried to bribe a judge with a plum position in Monaco. But once Sarkozy deals with this case, he's got another case coming up in about 3 or 4 months, relating to whether he also took a large amount of money in suitcases from Muammar Gaddafi's government in Libya. So it looks like Sarkozy is going to have his work cut out dealing with this current case around the Bettencourt finance. But if he gets through that one, he's got some trickier international related cases coming up in relation to Libya in a few months' time.
And finally, briefly, a brilliant story about an Emmy recipient who you wouldn't imagine would be normally up for it.
No, this is a piece in The Independent, and it's been in a lot of the US newspapers over the weekend, that the International Emmy Founders Award is going to go to none other than Governor Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, for the fact that his coronavirus briefings became absolutely essential viewing, not just for New Yorkers, but for all American citizens. This is quite remarkable. I think it shows just how effective, but also sort of morbidly entertaining Cuomo's coronavirus briefings became. And I think also the committee are sending a bit of a message here that Cuomo was in stark contrast to the ramblings from Trump and his administration. The backdrop to this, of course, is also just the horrific coronavirus death toll in New York City itself. It's estimated that something like 35,000 people have died from COVID-19 just in New York City. So there is a terrible backdrop to what is quite a humorous story about Governor Cuomo receiving this Emmy in the next couple of days.
Phil Clark, thank you as ever for bringing us a paper review on The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time now to get the latest business news with the financial analyst Louise Cooper. Louise, welcome back.
Good morning.
May we begin with a breaking news story that's happening in the United Kingdom. A third vaccine has had its reliability and success rate proven. It's the Oxford vaccine, but its success rate is, what, 70% protection?
Yeah, so this is the University of Oxford and the UK drug company AstraZeneca. They've released their effectiveness this morning. They think it's 70%, although very oddly, if they give the first jab at half levels of what they normally did, stranger, they got to 90%. So they need to look at the at quite how they dose it and things like that. But the headline number is 70%. And that's worse, of course, than the 95% protection that Pfizer and Moderna, the two American pharmaceutical companies, reported in the in the last couple of weeks. Now, there is a difference. The Oxford University vaccine is produced in the sort of very traditional way with a weakened form of the virus. The Pfizer and Moderna were using this messenger RNA. So they are different types. However, there are some advantages to the Oxford University vaccine. It's much, much cheaper. It's easier to store. So potentially this could be the vaccine for the developing world. And the UK government has ordered 100 million doses of the Oxford vaccine. So that could be enough. However, you know, you've got to bear in mind with all these vaccines, we have yet to get them into people on a mass in terms of mass vaccination program. And remember as well, particularly the Pfizer vaccine is going to be very difficult to logistically move around the world. As I told you before, it requires minus 70 degrees to be stored. Now, that is incredibly cold storage, and most of that doesn't actually exist around the world in the levels you need to be. So let's wait and see the response. AstraZeneca is also involved with the University of Oxford vaccination. News for Pfizer meant that the share price of Pfizer is up like 10% since they announced their excellent results. So we wait to see what happens to AstraZeneca share price this morning in about 10 minutes time.
It becomes an economic question, doesn't it? Because you just mentioned there that the, you know, if things pan out in the way that they are going at the moment, the Oxford vaccine will be the one for the developing world because it is cheaper. And it then becomes a question of government budgets. How much can they literally afford to protect their population?
Well, it's also, if it doesn't require extreme cold storage at minus 70 degrees, it becomes the drug for the vaccine for the developing world, because they can get it into people. I mean, the logistics of the Pfizer vaccine are incredibly difficult. So that is another reason. And like I said, although the headline figure is 70%, in slight changes of dosing, the headline effectiveness went up to 90%. So we're still waiting for the data. It's quite entertaining, actually. One of the UK national newspapers yesterday, they interviewed the chair of the Oxford vaccination group. And he said he's not in competition with Pfizer and Moderna, a fact I find quite surprising, and we're not in a rush. I think many politicians and many businesses were desperate for a vaccine, so I'm not sure that's completely accurate either. But I guess what he's trying to say is, look, you know, the demand for vaccine is so large, there's room for all of us, and of course we need to make sure it's incredibly safe and we've got all the data before we start immunizing a billion people around the world.
There's a with the realization that no one has been traveling anywhere for a very, very long time, and that this is an area of the world's business that does need to be kickstarted fast. The Chinese have come up with an idea to try and help people move more freely, and it all involves a QR code.
Yes, so the G20 was this weekend. It was this online meeting of global leaders in the 20 largest economies in the world. One of the things they talked about was the Paris Climate Change Agreement. They're hoping that with Biden in the White House, that will enable the US to rejoin. But as you said, there was also this plan, really promoted by the Chinese, to get the global travel industry back flying, back moving. You know, tens of millions of jobs are under threat in this industry. And China did suggest these personal QR codes. So you have a little code that's attached to you, say whether you're COVID positive or negative, maybe if you've had an antibody test, maybe if you're self-isolating, maybe if you're traveling from a high or low risk country. And the idea is that this would enable everybody to start traveling again. Now, of course, it sounds fantastic, particularly for those who are working in the industry. But what human rights organisations have warned is this may start as a sort of health certificate, but if you're not careful, this becomes, a tool for political monitoring and exclusion. QR codes widely used in China. Various places in China are planning to make them a permanent. But of course, you know, who has your data? How do they use it? Can they manipulate it? Are big issues if you're travelling around the world. You may be travelling from the UK to, you know, London to Beijing. You know, if London has access to your data, you might be okay with that. If Beijing has access to your data, you may not be okay with that, or vice versa. So, interesting idea. Lots of human rights concerns about it.
Louise Cooper, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, never perhaps has there been such a desire to let one's hair down and have some fun. Christmas decorations are pretty much a ubiquitous sight in many of the world's cities. But in the big shopping streets, the light may be dazzling above, but below, so many store windows are pitch black, the doors closed by coronavirus. So how will retail weather what is usually the best part of the year? And how will high streets fare when faced with online becoming the default way of doing our shopping? Well, I'm joined by Dana Thomas, Paris-based author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and The Future of Clothes. Welcome back, Dana. Good to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Lovely to speak with you.
There's an emphasis this year for the last couple of months on wise spending as opposed to just spending. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And a change of what people have been buying. You know, we're not just buying clothes and frivolous things. We're buying comfort wear, spa products, apparently some decent jewelry. Because, you know, a little sparkle always helps. And but definitely buying things we need versus luxuries, essentially.
And what is happening in terms of the way that we are buying? Obviously, because so many of us at the moment cannot actually get to a store, or even if we can, the shopping experience ain't what it used to be. We are buying default, but being moved on to online. So what are retailers doing with all this?
Well, retailers are having a hard time because sales in brick and mortar stores have collapsed. In the United States in September, the numbers dropped 4.6% and were off nearly 12% from a year earlier. And, you know, October was a disaster too, for things like fashion. Other things are flat, groceries, cars, decor is up. You're sitting around your house, you're redoing your house, but clothing is off. So they're trying to figure out new ways to do it, to sell to us. And some brands have come up with some cool ideas. Ralph Lauren has started a virtual store where you can go and visit their stores online, but you're walking through the Paris store, you're walking through the New York store, you're seeing the displays, and then you go like, wow, that shoe's really cool, and you can look at it in a 360-degree view. Much better than just like scrolling through one-dimensional photograph flat pictures on a web page, hundreds of them at a time. And they're also working with social media like Instagram. Instagram shopping has become bigger and bigger. Snapchat is launching sales and having a shopping interaction, so you can, and that's a much more fun way to shop than, again, just looking at a website like Net-a-Porter or Farfetch and just scrolling through pages and pages of black dresses. They're really trying to make it fun and sexy.
Talk to us about the sort of success rate of trying to make things fun and sexy. There is only so much that fun that one can have when you're looking at your phone with a bit of augmented reality, but that hasn't deterred anybody from really pursuing that approach, has it?
No, it hasn't. And so, you know, because of that, there are some measures that are being stepped in to save old school retailers, you know, the high streets retailers. In France this week, the French government announced on Friday that they're postponing Black Friday. Like, sorry, you can't have your Black Friday. My inbox has been, you know, drowning in Black Friday sales all morning this morning. And France said, you have to hold it off a week until December 4th so we can reopen our stores. And then you can have your sales, so we can give the high street, the small mom and pop shops, a chance to compete against, you know, all these online and virtual stores. These big companies that have lots of money and can invest in things like shopping virtually or on social media, because the big brands are going to drown out the independents. We have to be very careful otherwise.
Finally, when we are allowed to go back to shop at leisure and to take real pleasure and enjoyment in it, how much are we going to see that our shopping experience has been permanently changed by what's happened this year?
Well, I think it's going to be a bit like cinema. I was just reading this morning that Wonder Woman is opening in theaters and streaming at the same day, Christmas Day, that we don't have to wait a month or two or six to see Wonder Woman at home. I think we're going to have the same thing. You're going to have a hybrid that's going to be really, you know, a mix of bricks and mortar, but far less numbers of them in the big chains. We see that already. H&M and Zara closing stores by the hundreds and thousands around the world. I think you're going to see a lot of those chains disappear that you used to have seven of a certain brand in one town or one city, and now you'll have two. And there'll be much more online, social media, and virtual shopping. But at the same time, I think this will give a boost to independents, somebody who wants to come in and take over those empty spaces that have been dominated by these enormous global chains and do something independent, interesting. The concept store, which, you know, is such a 1990s idea, I think will come back. And you, when you go shopping, you'll go to places where you don't see everything that's the same as everywhere else. It will become individual and interesting and cool again. I think we're going to see a rise of the independent retailer, and we'll be thankful for it, and we'll support them because we want them to survive.
Dana Thomas, as ever, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache, Carlotta Ribello and Paige Reynolds, our researcher, Charlie Filmer-Court, and our studio manager, Maylie Evans, with editing assistance from Sean Hickey. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great week.